Even though my views on what we do has departed from my ODI roots, I have a deep love for Tony Ulrich and all the folks at Stratagen. And one of the things that Tony would often encourage me to do in the career was, Eric, don't wallow in getting stuck. Just reach out for help.
Welcome back, folks, to the Product Quest podcast. We pick up the action with the second half of our conversation with Eric Eske. In the last episode, Eric shared with us some of his methods of what he does to prepare to interview customers using Jobs to Be Done. But we get a bit more philosophical in this second episode as we talk about how Jobs to Be Done methods could be improved going forward. So let's jump right into it.
Scott, I'm going to just do a speed dating session here to list out a bunch of other things that I think are important for preparing for an interview.
Let's do it.
And you tell me where we want to dive deeper.
Let's do it.
Question storming. So instead of like brainstorming, we're brainstorming ideas. Here, we're brainstorming questions we would want to ask people. It's extremely powerful. We could talk about that. We could talk about a distinction between job maps, timelines, and root causes. Right? The job map originated from Tony and outcome-driven innovation. It's the idea of what must be done in order to accomplish a job. What I've discovered is that if instead you think of it as the timeline of events and the defining moments or situations that arise in which we could intervene with a new solution to create a new solution, you actually explore more options. And so I could tell you more about that. But then the third one is related to this idea that true outcomes are truly solution agnostic. And by way of a brief example, we started talking about a front lawn, right? Most people, when we talk about the outcomes that they want to have from their front lawn, they want it to be green and clean, free from weeds, of a uniform height. And we could probably go on and list maybe 15 true outcome-related metrics that are truly agnostic, whether I'm mowing the lawn, I have a lawn maintenance service, or it's artificial turf. And so one way that I love to prepare for interviews now is just think about those true outcome output related metrics, and then explore what are the root causes that causes them to be unfulfilled. So there's I know there's a lot there because there's no end to the amount of time I want to prepare for a customer interview. But those are like some major ideas that I found that helped me to be really effective in preparation.
Let's dig into those a little bit. And then if you've got some more of these speed dating things, I'd love to hear them, because that last one is I probably tell Eric every other week this. It just blew my mind. It blew my mind that I never thought about it. And just to reiterate, just to take the lawn, the mowing the lawn example, spending time at John Deere, I've studied that job as well. So we're talking about this and this word outcome. It's like we need some more words or something. anyway, but like a set of needs, let's say, that are truly independent of the method. So if we're studying the job of Scott mowing the lawn, you get things about physical effort and the time to do it, about the process of mowing the lawn, and you know the likelihood I might bang the equipment into something, right? Or whatever, the dispersion of grass, like if I'm mowing it, that's the thing. Just all the things that are unpleasant, you'll get that about my experience with it. But then what Eric's talking about, this set of outcomes that's independent of whether I did it or if I hire somebody to do it or if I have a goat in the yard or if I purchase some kind of AstroTurf, right? Where it's just the quality of the final product. Independent. And another example that comes to mind is preparing a meal. It's an example we like to use in jobs world because people prepare a meal. What are the steps preparing a meal? Then you would have but you could also purchase a meal, right? You could hire a restaurant. So what are these results or whatever? What are the needs that are independent of whether you hired a restaurant or did it yourself? What are the needs that are independent of whether you mowed it yourself or if you hired somebody to do it? And when Eric and I, it was only when we did a project together recently, and he showed me this class, I was like, I tell this, Eric, weekly, but I found it's like, how did I never think of that? That sounds so obvious to me now. Eric, you're going to have to tolerate me here saying it more because I'm struck by how much work I've done and that never occurred to me. Anyway, yeah. I'll let Jan and Jonathan respond to that one. Does that make sense?
Well, I think we had an interesting discussion during a previous podcast, episode 36, with Andrew DiMeo. And I think we touched upon that question a bit. And what I'm wondering is, are there really needs? Can we really distinguish needs in this way, or is it really related to a bad definition of needs somehow? And I because if you think about it, if needs are somehow these end states, having grass a certain level, blah blah blah, well, any end state can be reached in various amounts of weight. So for example, if I look at my lawnmower, I need to go and get the lawnmower. Okay. So I need to get the lawnmower in the garden. So I can have a state where the lawnmower is in the garden and I can do this many different ways. I need to start the lawnmower. Okay. So this lawnmower needs to be be running. This is a state that I can achieve in many different ways. And here we're clearly in kind of talking about lawnmowers and its solution space. So I kind of feel in a way there's a distinction to be made when we're talking about states that are defined. Of course, there's many different ways to reach these states. The problem is solutions are not single states. They are a set of interrelated states, and that's how I would really distinguish these things, and there all the problems kind of fade away, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's something I'm trying to do that I haven't really talked with people yet about, is I'm trying to redefine what jobs to be done is, actually propose a new theory of what it fundamentally is. So if I get a little bit theoretical and abstract, please forgive me.
We're in the right place. This is where
we're in the right place.
Exactly the right place.
I believe that jobs to be done is about what transformations people want and don't want and why. And a transformation is a very interesting word, because in order to have a transformation, you have to have something that you're trying to change. There's an input state, there's an output state, and there's a process that performs the transformation. So like in the case of, like, pretend that John Deere is a client and we're talking about their business, presumably, which is around lawn tractors. Well, a lawn tractor is a solution for transforming attributes of grass. So if we pay attention to what transformations we want and don't want to grass, then it becomes a very short, succinct list of things that we want to change about it. Its color, its height, its density on the lawn, maybe its firmness, so it's comfortable to lay on, maybe the degree to whether it's wet or not, and so on. And like those types of descriptions, and then how we would transform them, can be completely independent of the solution, not just like a job map that might describe that I prepare and then I mow the lawn and so on. But it's truly agnostic. And like, I want to, this is something that I miss not being a member of Tony's firm, Stratagen, is the opportunity to debate ideas like this. So maybe we could do that together here in a group. I have this controversial statement that all job maps are solutions. They always presume a solution because a process by definition assumes some sort of platform. But when you think about it in terms of this idea of transformations, there's only 15 or so transformations we want to do to our front lawn, just 15 needs. And now whatever process we put in service of producing those desired transformations, I want the process that takes the least time, the least cost, the least effort. And so to put it in a little bit more concrete terms, If in the job domain, you can identify the object that you want to transform, then the outputs are the adjectives that describe the ideal output. And the ideal process to produce those outputs are described by adverbs related to time, cost, and effort, and so on. And so I think there's a conception here of being able to say that there's really only 20, maybe 25 needs for any job in any part of the world, as long as you can describe it in this type of way. And then when you want to do something more akin to customer experience innovation, then yes, do the job map for using a lawn tractor to produce those same outputs. And then you'll get those intermediate states that are incredibly important to product and marketing design, but not truly solution agnostic needs. We're presuming there's a solution. I threw a lot there.
Yeah. So yeah,
I have two big thoughts. Well, one is we might not want to publish this. The IP, there might be too much IP in here that we just want to keep amongst us. But that's one thought. The next one is I'm thinking about what Jonathan said and what Eric said. Jonathan described getting to a state, like, and then Eric's describing a transformation. And so I'm thinking from one state to another state. And so the goal is, that's one of the problems with all this is just language, right? But I think we can all sort of understand that. So the ultimate might be this state, whatever this state, final state is. And then regardless of whether they call it a job or whatever, and the goal is, or language fails me, what we want to achieve is this transformation to achieve whatever that final state is. And that's that idea of transformation, that's consistent with Christensen's later writings, when he used the term progress a lot. But anyway, so sorry, I'm just sort of, I'm saying this out loud just to sort of understand it myself.
Here we get into, I think, maybe we're going to lose some listeners. I don't know, but it's, I think, very interesting discussion to me anyway.
Yeah.
So first, the idea of transformation, I don't think is the same, in my opinion, as the idea of a goal or a job as it's understood. But we're not quite clear. I think the definition of job could be improved, in my opinion, for exactly that reason. So transformations for me is something slightly different. And then I wanted to also bounce off what you said, Eric, on this notion of adverbs. I think for a simple job, all outputs are adverbs. So you, except for the actual job that you're looking at, all the, what we're calling these outputs are somehow adverbs. So let me give an example. Let's take the classical make a hole in the wall example. So the hole in the wall is a state and it's an output. It is an output that you might want, an output of some process, undefined process. So there are many other outputs that you will get in the physical world, because nothing ever happens in isolation. So you might, you know, annoy your neighbors if you use a drill, and that's an output that's also part of that specific process. You might crack your wall and you know, make it worse than it was, and that's also an output that you might not want. You also have the output you want, which is the hole in the wall. There's also, and that is, I think, in a metaphysical sense, maybe difficult to classify as an output, but I think the time you've spent is of a slightly different nature, but could also be considered an output. You have less time now than you had before. And also the energy you've spent doing this, you have less of energy, you've spent energy, so there's a different output. So essentially, if we look at this, we want the hole in the wall, but there's a whole network of other effects that happens that are outputs, and that generally speaking, we don't want. What we want is just that hole in the wall. And so for me, I think basically these other outputs would be, for me, the adverbs. Okay, maybe you were talking about adverbs in terms of maybe the time and energy, but I don't see a fundamental reason to kind of separate these two. So the annoyed neighbors, the time, the energy, for me, they're all basically negative outputs that you want to get rid of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The same occurs to me in the context of surgery, right? We always want to minimize the likelihood of complications, and that list of complications is quite long and comprehensive and usually tied to the solution that's being used to perform the surgery. It's almost as if the problems and the waste that can occur from using a particular platform to get a job done also presents a set of needs that we want to minimize and avoid, because they're just bad things that are unuseful for actually producing what we truly want, which is that perfectly round hole suitable for its next purpose.
Yeah.
Can I just maybe jump in a little bit? So I think most of the project, yes, there is a kind of a solution. There is a solution there somehow, or some kind of solution is assumed. And I think it's always kind of a balancing act between how far away do you actually go from the solution, because sometimes going too far away from the solution isn't also really helpful. So maybe could you illustrate a little bit, like you mentioned that these more solution related outcomes, let's say, are really helpful for marketing and product and so on. But then what is kind of the additional power, or the additional advantage that these completely solution-free things give you? Like what can you do with them that's kind of different from the things that you could do that are more related to the solution?
Oh, so these are all tools to address like one of the two really huge risks in innovation, which is just that narrow framing of the problem causes us to miss something that's valuable. And so the ODI toolkit of job map, and desired outcome statements are a tool in service of widening our options. And I think what we're talking about widens our options just in a different way. And like one of my favorite industries, no joke, is agriculture. I'm in love with the idea of creating the work that we do in service to the world in the spirit of a benefit corporation. And one of the UN's global priorities is to eliminate hunger. So I think agriculture is a really ripe area to apply this type of thinking to really expand our impact. And so in the world of agriculture, we could go to one of the multinationals that serves the space. And let's say they're a chemical company. And so they're producing pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and so on. So they might want to frame the job as to control disease and pests, or prevent them in the first place, some variation of that very concrete job. And that would give them really great insight on everything they care about in R&D to develop a new insecticide or pesticide, but also from a marketing perspective. Now, you could say, and I think actually Stratagen uses this in their book for a company, a case study related to Syngenta, where they say, no, the job is to grow corn, right? And that's a perfectly valid job statement too. And it expands the options, right? Because it's now not just the disease, it's now other aspects of growing like soil condition and so on. But what's the other way of framing the job? Now, like when you actually go talk with farmers and you ask them what they're really trying to accomplish, it's to earn a return on their investment.
Yeah.
And case in point, one of the big solution areas in agriculture now is something called agrivoltaics, where they're installing solar panels about, I don't know, a couple of meters above the farmland. It collects sunlight, produces electricity. It doesn't interfere with photosynthesis, and it helps them to get other growing jobs or get other parts of the growing job done better, because it helps to retain moisture at the field level. Now, if we had framed the job just around pesticides and herbicides, we would definitely miss the agrivoltaics as a solution opportunity. Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. And I always hate that the answer to the question being, well, you need to look at all three levels. But the truth is you do, because one is related to how do we grow the current business? Growing a crop, you might say, helps us to expand that into adjacencies. But the third really gets to what farmers really truly care about, which is if I don't make money this season to fund next season, there's not going to be a farm to do this on. And we need all that context to really make good strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this. Unfortunately, it does depend.
It does. Well, here's the other false dichotomy that I've been noticing in this world that we practice in, is that a lot of providers, in my experience, will try to funnel people to study one job and one job executor. But that is an artificial recommendation based on the expense it takes to hire consultants with 20 plus years of experience and the expense of the research. It's time to put that into a bucket where that's appropriate for big multinational companies that can make that sort of investment. Now, what do we do for the 97% rest of the innovators and entrepreneurs who want to make a difference with this methodology, but can't afford that? It's like there's a huge opportunity to dramatically reduce the cost. It's not unlike saying, like, how would Clay posthumously, you know, reinvent how we practice jobs to be done so it could be available to the masses. I think that's the really unspoken opportunity in our work.
I think one thing Clay would tell us, well, he had lots of warnings for incumbents, right? And what are the mistakes he said incumbents are going to do? Wow, this might hit close to home. But I never thought about applying it to myself. I always applied it to big companies. But, you know, one of them is, you know, that they're only going to evaluate things based on margin. So if something's a big margin, something's a small margin, they're going to look at it and say, stop doing the small margin stuff. Only do the big margin stuff, which causes you to, by the way, in that small margin thing that big margin business might be going away, and the small margin, that might be the disruptive thing that's going to ultimately replace it. That would be one of the warnings Christensen would give to any incumbent. But as incumbents, if you will, if we are within jobs to be done, maybe that's a warning for us in the space. You know, that would be one thing. The other thing he would say is, he would say that, you know, a company's greatest strength, like if it's great capabilities and making steel or whatever, it becomes a hindrance to seeing the benefits of a lesser solution, a so-called crappy lower end solution, and that we would dismiss it. Any incumbent would dismiss it. And so presumably we're vulnerable to those same. And then thirdly, he would say you can't do it. If I understand him correctly, he would say because there's too many headwinds, you're chasing after the big margins, you're deep in your thing, you can't do it. You have to have different. He would recommend a company literally get different people. Now, I'm not quite as that pessimistic, quite frankly. I mean, I guess that's on average, but I don't know. I think having a lot of things, the 12 steps, AA, first step's admitting you have a problem, right? And from there, maybe you can build on that. Anyway, sorry, that inspired some thinking about what Clay would think, because he spoke to it. I'm not sure I like the answers.
that yeah, well, true things are hard, right? But
yeah,
but I love this kind of mission that you just shared there, of saying, hey, how can we democratize the approach or make it available to? I think that is really, I mean, I love that mission and that approach. Like, how is that what you are doing at the moment right now? Is that kind of what you're working on? Yeah. So,
oh, completely. Okay. Yeah. But I mean, Scott and I collaborated on the project for the past, what is it, 4 or 5 months? And poor Scott, all he hears me lament. Like, I love doing our work, but what he also hears me saying is that I really want to be working on developing this other way of doing it because of the impact it could have. And wouldn't that be exciting? Like just to throw something out there just for fun. All right. Let's say that a typical jobs you've done project takes 4 months to do end to end. And clients are going to spend, you know, six figures doing that. Now, what would happen if we could do that in a month and it only cost two figures? Yeah. I mean, that gives me goosebumps to think about. And I have ideas, but I don't know how to do it completely. But if we could, it would change the world.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with, like, I have no aspirations to become rich. But like, if I could look back on my career and say, you know what, this unleashed a wave of innovation across the world that eliminated hunger or poverty or help people to be healthier. It's like, I feel like that's a life well lived.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I love that. I love that approach.
Okay. Just to circle back around an earlier comment, Eric, you mentioned that, you know, based on the constraints of cost and time and hiring expertise, a typical project, one job executor, very deep, big sample, long time, time and money investment. And so you described the benefits of, or maybe I'll let you describe it, but essentially how might you study more job executors? Could you elaborate on that a bit?
One of my good friends, he's a longtime practitioner in this way of thinking. I would actually recommend him be another possible guest for you. His name is Michael Marin, and he is an expert in mergers and acquisitions. He cut his teeth early in his career with GE, and GE takes this very financial engineering type approach to M&As, right? You identify undervalued targets, you bring them in, you reduce the cost out, you move on to the next target. Now, when he got introduced to this way of thinking jobs to be done, he realized he could completely re-architect the process. And so like the conversation with him is about how does jobs to be done change mergers and acquisitions, identifying attractive prospects and valuing them and encouraging them to become part of the team. And he says, Eric, the way that this changes the game is that I don't want to take away his thunder, but he doesn't do any quantitative work. He says, I just want to identify all of the job executors in a particular ecosystem. I want their job maps. I want an understanding of their needs. And then I will use third-party data to do some economic assessments to figure out where are the opportune investment areas from a needs perspective. And then I'll go identify target companies that are working on fulfilling those needs either in less time or for less cost. He's been doing this now for about 5 years. His results far exceed his peers. And I think the way that he's applying it in that M&A context is the same way that we can apply it if we're at a portfolio level, working at an executive level or a board level, or working for product managers. In our next medical study, it's not just the physician, it's the patient, it's the circulating nurse scrub nurse inside of the OR. It's also the payer. And even if we can't go quite as deep because they're expensive audiences to reach, we'll use third-party data as part of our opportunity assessment mechanism. So maybe it is a traditional survey with physicians, but for everyone else, we're just using the data that we can access, but we're going to create a complete view so that we can come up with a complete strategy rather than myopically, this is what the physicians want, but we miss the real need. Like Scott, I don't know if you feel open to mentioning this, but we had a direct example of this where we discovered an unmet or an overmet physician need. But when you actually talk with people, it turns out it's an unmet patient need. So you wouldn't want to trade it off.
All right. Nice. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'll tell you the example that actually comes to mind. It's the area that I've always found the most confounding is actually if you build stuff that go in commercial buildings. Let me give an example. Imagine you make faucets to go in commercial building. All right. Who are you going to study? You're going to study you're going to study the installer, the contractor that installs them. That'd be a very valid job to study. Wait a minute. What about the architect? The architect selects them based on style and you know, things. But wait a minute, what about the facility manager? Facility manager's in charge of the facility of which the spigots are a part. Maybe you should study their needs. Wait a minute, there's people using that facility, you know, based on how long it takes the water to come on. They've got needs. You know, hold on. What about like the person that's repairing them? I mean, every business sort of has this, but commercial buildings, if you build stuff that goes in commercial buildings, I find in particular there, if you just select one, you're missing so much of the wider ecosystem. So I think I love this idea. I love this idea of leaving a bit. We have to make a trade-off, right? You can't have everything. But so I love the idea of I'll surrender a bit of statistical power, if you will, for one single executor. And instead, I'll have an 80% solution for half a dozen or whatever of the stakeholders. It's sort of a radical idea. I don't know if we want to publish this. This might be too valuable. Maybe we'll have a new paid version. You have to subscribe.
This episode is a paid one.
Go ahead.
Go on, sorry.
I want to get to this job map timeline thing. So, but before I switch topics, because Eric's got some interesting thinking around that. But before I switch topics, do you guys have any other follow-ups about what we just discussed?
Well, not follow-ups, but maybe just I want to say that I love. I mean, this is for me. This is exactly what Jobs to Be Done is also about. I mean, it's you want to get somewhere, and that somewhere is you want to know what are the unmet needs of the people that are kind of involved in the stuff that we produce, and maybe we can't get all the way, right? But it's getting 60% of the way is so much better than getting nowhere. So I love this approach and this kind of thinking of how can we find other means and ways of getting to those needs, those unmet needs, and they might be different and they might be, but still better than gut feel or having no clue at all. So I love the approach. That's just what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
We have to have Eric on the show more because normally we're too busy working. This is the conversation I'm always wanting to have. We never have time for it because we always have.
And
we have too much.
You know what I love? We started kind of something like an hour ago or so, or even more, and we said, "Well, Eric is really that great guy on the quantitative stuff, and we should get there in a moment." And now we've
qualitative interviews and all that kind of stuff.
we'll have him back. But Eric has some very interesting thinking around job map and timeline. I wonder if you could, and he mentioned it briefly. I wonder if you could share that with us.
Yeah, I'll do my best. The original conception of job mapping, at least as I've understood it, is what must be done in order to get the job done. So it's very, very focused on step one leads to step two. And if you sequence those steps through all the way through 10 steps, you'll eventually have the entire job done. And I think that can be a very useful way of looking at a market. But what I've found is that it doesn't always complement how people psychologically actually operate in the world. Oftentimes what I experience is that people are presented with a situation, and inside that situation, desires arise. We don't know from where, but people have desires in that situation. And they look at what they want, but what they don't have, and then look at their ability, the skills, the resources, the products or services available in that situation. And then they use their beliefs to guide which solutions they select. And then they try to pursue their desires to get some needs satisfied. Now, if that's true, if that's psychologically what's actually happening, then it occurred to me that it's actually much more useful in terms of gathering needs to identify what are all the different moments, events, and so on. And I really am not, I don't care whether they happen in a specific linear order timeline. I don't actually care if it's actually tied to the ultimate job we've done or not. But if this situation arises, I want to understand inside that situation all the needs. And so by reframing a job map as a timeline of events, what we do is we give ourselves permission to be more relaxed about what moments we're going to use to anchor our needs gathering in a qualitative interview. And it serves the further purpose of if we frame the job too narrowly, we might miss something valuable. But I know for a fact that if my product exists in a certain moment in a customer's timeline, and there's other needs in that timeline, whether that's part of the job that I serve or not, that I'm present in that moment, which means I could deliver value in that moment. And so I want to be aware of the other needs in those moments at the same time. So I call it a timeline.
Does this relate in some way to Bob Moyster's Switch interviews?
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know, because I actually haven't studied Bob's work deeply enough to know. But what do you think?
I think it does. I mean, the interviews, he's got this whole, it's basically a timeline-based thing. So the whole idea is, it starts with I don't remember the details exactly, but it basically starts with a trigger. It's about, your back hurts and you think it's probably got to do with your bed. And so suddenly the need arises to get another bed. And so it's all about understanding how people switch between different solutions. So what I would say is, it does relate. It's very much based on the timeline of how people make decisions. And he's got this thing of the four forces, you know, where you're pulled more in towards new solution or towards staying with your old solution. So it's a slightly different take, but I think there are some similarities there.
Where Bob Moyster focuses on is kind of what does the sales process look like? Like what it's, I mean, he very much emphasizes this, like jobs done for sales. Yeah. And then he kind of has this timeline of there's an initial unconscious phase of looking at solutions. And then you consciously look at I think he calls it also a timeline, but I think it's very strongly that focus on sales, and probably the focus on innovation is, maybe that's a different kind of timeline. Or at least I would assume, like the way you describe it, it sounds a little bit different. But what I really like is I think there is, I mean, this the job map can help as a kind of a starting point. But I think it's very often and very quickly you will find like, okay, what step goes where, and then that's never really clear. Like it's never really that kind of sequence. If you look, so that I like that you kind of loosen this up a little bit and say, well, there's moments, but like,
yeah,
what is a moment then? Like what, how do you distinguish moments?
Well,
or situations?
Jumped out at me when Eric had a project. I've been sitting here trying to think of another example because I can't share the exact one, but let's just stick with mowing the lawn. Let's imagine if you're looking at the steps of what you do and mow the lawn and then you realize, you know, during mowing the lawn, what somebody does is they get off their mower to pick up trash. That has nothing to do with mowing the lawn, nothing at all. Now, the way that jobs, okay, typical our approaches might say, you'd ask for related jobs. And you say, well, what else are you trying to do while mowing the lawn? Mm. So maybe you could act your job map for mowing the lawn and you have your other things. But with this project we recently did, There was this one real important thing. And so there was not this long list of related jobs. There was one, but it was important. And so I was like, I mean, I guess in creating a survey, I don't want a section with just one item in it. I feel like, so something's not right. But for mowing the lawn, maybe that's, you know, picking up trash while mowing the lawn, maybe that's sort of the most harmless example I could think of. It has nothing to do with mowing the lawn, but while you're on that machine, that's something that you will spend.
That arises. That's a very interesting example. Yeah, Scott. So I like it a lot. So it's a job that would arise as you're actually pursuing another job. Let's say you're doing something else and you suddenly have this other.
And what makes them in common is that they're arising at the same moment in time, at the same location, where there's a match in location frequency and themes, so to speak, where it may lead you to a different product idea.
Yeah, the context.
That's very interesting.
You have a common context for accomplishing both jobs. And so, yeah, it's been stretching my thinking a lot.
And the question, of course, is then how do you actually gather these jobs in an interview? Because it seems that you could have an infinity. I mean, if you just talk abstractly about mowing the lawn, I could say, well, you know, there's maybe tons of others. It could be like, okay, well, you hit your head against a branch and you think you have to cut a branch or something. I don't know, whatever. It's probably not a very good example, but you see what I mean? I mean, you have to be very, very creative. It's virtually impossible to actually guess that you need to think about picking up the trash unless you've experienced mowing the lawn yourself and you've seen that this is something that often will happen while you're here. You're actually cutting the grass. You're in that state of mind of making a place look nice and you see some trash. So it's natural because of your state of mind and what you're doing that you'll go and pick up. You want to also pick up the trash. It makes sense. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if this is a full answer, but one technique is to first, if we recognize that no job happens without a prompt, like there's always some trigger that causes some synapses to fire where we now have a desire to get a job done. So we can simply ask respondents to help us create an inventory. Well, where are you located and at what moments in time does this desire to get this job done come up in your life? And it's probably a fairly succinct list, but then for each of those moments, we can use them as an anchor in the interview to say, well, what else are you trying to do? We can apply the WHOOP framework in each of those different moments. And again, just expand what we're considering.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing, I just think good old contextual, if you can use the word ethnographic, or somebody will say, I'm not using the word ethnographic, right? But watching somebody perform the job in the context in which they perform it, you notice they pick up trash. Oh, you notice there's, or a real example, a commercial cutter, they'll have a big 5-gallon bucket on their mower. What's that? You respond to the environment. About what you, their workarounds, all those type of things also. And things that somebody might not, if you're interviewing them about mowing the lawn, they might not think to bring it up, but you go watch them do it. And then the environment becomes your discussion guide.
But that's super interesting. I mean, we call these triggers. I don't know if that's the same kind of thing. We call these kind of triggers.
Yeah.
It's theoretically an underdeveloped concept, right? But we call whatever these things are, we call them triggers, and that can be terribly useful information. So we did a project on chocolate, for example, and I mean, what the job of chocolate is not that easy to define, and it tremendously matters. Like, is it in the morning? Is it lunch? Is it in the evening? That's a very different kind of, but I would even go so far as to say the job is different. So there is a kind of the 10 o'clock chocolate is something else than the 4 o'clock and the one after dinner. So I think it's
10 o'clock chocolate is only in Switzerland though.
Right. So well, getting back to the weight problem, but anyway, I really like this because I think it yes, there is probably like a common thread that runs through the whole day and the whole kind of what chocolate is about thing, but it gives such a strong spin, let's say, on what the job is or the flavor of the job. I don't know how to describe this. It really matters, especially for marketing, and the product can be the same, but for marketing purposes, that matters a lot. Like if you talk about the morning, but the actual thing happens in the, it's like, it matters. So I really like that this is kind of has found its way into your thinking.
Yeah. There's another really valuable aspect of starting with that prompt or the trigger as an anchor for gathering needs. It's because you can also say, oh, my dear client, you're not even present in this situation when that need arises. So all of a sudden it creates a growth path without having to change the product at all. You just have to create a new channel to be present in that moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so much I want to share.
Well, I have like 20 questions we didn't get to, but
do we have time for one more?
It's up to you.
I have tons of questions.
We've got
still.
All the time. We want to be respectful of your time.
Like there is...
I would be selfish if I just gave you one more thing. So I want to give you the option. Do you want to hear?
Yes.
I would love to share, or should we go to your questions?
No. We want what you've got.
Yeah.
I'm going to drag you back in here anyway.
All right. At the risk
that's very likely to happen.
All right. I'm going to risk being controversial again to some of our JavaSuite then friends. The conventional thinking is to gather importance and satisfaction data in a survey, right? You want to know which, you want to focus on the most important needs that are the least satisfied, right? That's intuitively obvious. And I dare say it's actually wrong. Here's why. A client who's a portfolio manager at a venture firm gave me a call to get some advice. And we were talking about satisfaction. And so this is how we discussed. I said, Darren, please pick any job that you personally do in your life. And he so happened to pick mowing the lawn. I said, Darren, how satisfied are you with your ability to mow the lawn? He says, oh, I'm very satisfied. He's got all the tools. He's got the skills. He's got a lifetime experience. Okay, I said, all right, Darren, on average, how much time do you spend each week mowing the lawn? He said, oh, maybe it's an hour. Sometimes it's an hour and a half. I said, okay, on average, how much are you spending over the course of the year to take care of your lawn? And he said, well, maybe a couple thousand, $3,000. I said, Darren, I have a solution for you. Would you like to hear it? Instead of it taking an hour and a half, it's only going to take you 30 minutes. Instead of costing you $3,000 a year, it's only going to cost you $300 a year. Would you like to hear more about it? And he said, yes, of course. I'm excited about it. So I reflect on the story to convince Darren of this, that he was very satisfied, which means that in a quant, we would think that's not an opportunity. However, if we come up with an offer that gets the job done better, because it saves you time, reduces your cost, reduces your effort, he's interested and wants to learn more. So is it an opportunity or not? Of course, I think it absolutely is. And so if I go to the punchline, I want to persuade the JavaSuite community to make two changes in how we do our surveys. First, I want to move away from satisfaction and use metrics that relate to the ease or the difficulty of getting certain aspects of the job done. And yes, that does relate to time and cost and effort, but you can simply just use a scale of easy to difficult. And every time that I've done this, I get respondents that are using the full range of the scale. So some needs are definitely easy and some are definitely very difficult. And so we get really good discrimination about where we can potentially help them to get aspects of the job done easier. But then the other side of it, the important side of the equation, here's the irony of our work. If we do a really good job of gathering needs in the qualitative phase, we've only gathered the critical needs. And so in practice, in the US, for example, I find that if you use a 5-point importance scale from not at all important to extremely important, almost everyone's toggling between very and extremely important. So we give respondents a 5-point scale, but we're only getting 2 points of response. It's almost as if we're a scientist and we're using an ineffective measuring instrument to get insight. And so I think there's an opportunity to replace the importance metric with a different metric. And there's actually some really compelling research. There's two sources I could lead you to, but what they basically say is that motivation is multidimensional. It's just not whether something's valuable. It's also influenced by whether I'm confident in my ability to get the job done. It's somewhat moderated if it takes, you know, months or weeks or years to get a reward from doing the job.
Yeah.
So looking at the literature, there's actually the suggestion that there's 4 metrics that describe different levels or different factors of motivation. I believe those 4 factors should replace importance. Instead of satisfaction, we should be looking at ability. And I think there's 5 factors there. And even though in a survey, we can't give our respondents 9 factors, it's like, it's way too complicated. But using the model as a way of thinking about what should we actually go ask respondents about really opens up the game. And every time that I've done something different than important and satisfaction, we've learned something extremely valuable, been able to compare it against using important satisfaction, and like said, it was worth leaving the important satisfaction world because of it.
So may I comment? So love your points, and I would like to comment on the first one. So basically, you've taken down both of the points of the survey. So satisfaction and importance are basically all there is. So well done. On the satisfaction side, I'm very much in agreement, and I would say it's actually, this relates very much to this question we discussed at the beginning, which is related to the, you know, how can we separate the problems and solutions? The eternal question, how is it that problems and solutions are separated? And I think it's very much separated. It's very much related to that. And the reason is because satisfaction is relative, essentially. People are satisfied if they feel that, okay, they're doing something, there's no better way of doing this, you know, so I'm satisfied with this because I believe it's good. But if suddenly they learn that, oh, my neighbor's doing the same thing and it costs, it's cheaper and it's much better, I'm not satisfied anymore. I'm pissed off. And it goes back to this notion of justice somehow. There's this very fun video people can look up on YouTube where it's two monkeys in a cage, and they basically have to do some action and get a reward. And one gets a cucumber and the other one gets a raisin. And the one who gets the raisin, they love raisins and cucumbers. Yeah, it's okay. And so the one who gets the raisin starts throwing, who gets the cucumber starts throwing the cucumbers back to the experimenter, not because he feels that's an injustice there, you know, the same task is not. And so satisfaction is relative. And this, I think I also want to bring back something in Scott's book, The Statue and the Stone, which is, he talked about, I think it's the magic pill or the magic ring. I forget exactly what it's called, but this technique of, and basically the idea is to say, okay, let's imagine now that you eat a magic pill or something, and you can now just do whatever you want. I think I don't remember exactly how you framed it, but essentially
similar to the wishes in Eric's book.
It's like the wish thing. Okay, you can just boom. Now it's, and I always think about the idea of teletransportation, the Star Trek thing. You can just boom, you go to a different place. Well, isn't that the perfect product? Isn't that the perfect solution for any, if you can just have a wish, okay, have the lawn mode, boom, done. Just, clap your hands and it's done. Or not even that, just think about it, boom, it's done. You know, that's magic. If you think about any kind of thing we want to do, you just think about the end goal, the end state you want, and it realizes itself. That's magic, and that's the perfect solution, and that's what you chip away. Getting back to your statue in the stone, you chip away all the things you don't want to get to that in the end. That's what you want, and so I think the satisfaction thing is very much related. All this to say that it's very much related to this issue of nothing really stands on its own and in isolation. Problems, jobs are always very intimately related to the existing solutions and competitive landscape that's available to people.
I was going to say, when I first read Tony's book a long time ago, the thing that's really apparent to me is this describes two different things, not completely different, but one is a market research process. The other is just this mindset way of thinking. That's why I sort of called it a philosophy, to try to include everything. But when we're speaking of the challenges with the research process, but we can still use the thinking, even if the research process doesn't always, to your point, Eric, is there a research study that would have shown us, like the DVR, or would have shown us, oh, streaming? I don't think so, right? But it's when, like, so when I was in engineering school, and I was in engineering school is when I realized that music could be digital, that music could be data. It's like, oh, wow. So I said, well, I know what the record store of the future is going to be. You're going to have a chip. You're going to go into your record store. You're going to plug it in and you're going to download your songs. That was how I imagined the future, because I didn't have the internet in that link of technologies, you know. I think this definitely speaks to a couple of things, a weakness of Drop-U9 as a research process. And also, you know, I think we need to be forthcoming about the limitations of our solution, Jobs to Be Done, and the things that I don't think that Jobs to Be Done could have been used to say, oh, we should develop the DVR, right? It was some kind of technical breakthrough from the other side. So we're so big on pushing back on ideas first. You know, we need to call a little time out. And if there's an idea that just absolutely destroys the current value that people think of, then we can't invalidate it with Jobs to Be Done. I don't know if I'm making a coherent thought, but
But can I just maybe a couple of ideas? So I think I love that you're challenging the core of how we do this, and I like that you do this, because I think it's a model, right? It's a model, and it has its merits and it has its issues. I even think that importance is relative to solutions, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll get anything that is really not relative to something else. I don't think that really exists. So, but it's better than having nothing. But I love your additions, like around it, to making it more complex. Well, we've been, and maybe, I don't know if you have been thinking about this, there is one thing that we're always trying to find ways to connect Jobs to Be Done to, and it's called the health belief model. It's and I want to point you to it just for because I feel like that might be going in that direction, which is I probably can't produce it like it theory says it should be reproduced, but it kind of says there is four different so the question it tries to answer is how to motivate people to do something that is medically better but they don't, for example, quit smoking or get a mammogram or whatever, like all these kinds of things that from a medical standpoint you should do but people don't, or not all of the people do. And then they kind of have like four factors that kind of and you mentioned a couple of those. So that's why I thought of it. It's like the ability to do so, the perceived benefit of the solution, the risk you think you're, so like it's in healthcare. So how much do I think am I really at risk for cancer if I smoke? And then there is a fourth one which I don't remember, but I loved it because I think that, I mean, we're trying to understand human beings, and that's a very complex thing. And I think we can all agree that it's not just importance and satisfaction that kind of captures this, because that would be, I mean, that's just, it, that cannot be. So I love that your extension on this. I mean, we really need to broaden, I think, our understanding of how humans work. I mean,
this is my current area of research. It goes back to the qualitative process, but there's this remarkable book that I'm reading called Honest Signals. And it's written by a researcher who developed this monitoring system. You wear it on a loop, like a necklace, and it has a device that records heart rate, body positioning, and so on. And he originally set it up in the context of a board meeting, board members making decisions about an investment proposal. And they could actually predict with something like 90%+ accuracy what their decision would be before they voiced it, because of these hidden signals that don't come out of our verbal speaking channel. And I've always thought that when we have respondents take a survey, we're putting them into a mode of thinking that's somewhat rational, but their responses are coming subconsciously, but it's a slice of a much bigger picture. And so I think this idea of like, let's get a framework that encompasses the big picture, even if we can only sample certain slices of it, but let's have the holistic view, because people are incredibly complex. And if we want to improve our ability to predict, it can't be through singular instruments or mechanisms. We have to have a comprehensive view.
Yeah. But how would you, I mean, if you, let me play a little bit devil's advocate as well. So if I'm pushing back and saying, but the beauty of it is, You have two numbers, you do a survey, you have one result, it's very clear where to go, and now you're making all these kind of complexities. Like that would, so that would kind of, what would you say to a kind of a pushback like that?
Well, the what's right and predictive is sometimes complex, but we can separate that from how do we actually communicate it so that it is simple and effective and to the point. I think there are two different issues. And it turns out there's something called, forgive me for being theoretical again, but there's something, I'll find the academic name for it, but it's just like there's something called capital allocation theory when it comes to making investment decisions. There's one that's related to this idea of creating knowledge work systems. I think it's called attention capital theory, something to that effect. And what they've actually discovered in experimenting with this theory is that adding complexity to a process actually produces a far better result than the simple version of the process. And so it's convinced me to say that complicated processes could actually be very good, but we have to separate that from how do we communicate the impact or results of that process to stakeholders so that they can understand it effectively and quickly.
Okay. Yeah, I see that.
So if you ever catch me presenting, hey, there's these nine factors, and like just I can share that with you because we're all nerds, so to speak. I say that in the most loving way. But like when I actually communicate this with clients, I say it's not so much important to satisfaction, it's much more about motivation and ability.
Okay.
And then I give them a case example to say, well, importance and satisfaction doesn't explain why some weight loss solutions are better or worse than others in terms of motivating people to act, but motivation ability is a deeper explanation of why. And so, yeah.
That's sort of the challenging.
Always struggle, yeah.
That's sort of the challenging part of being, which as a job to be done consultant say, we have to sort of stay in a couple different worlds. I think we have to challenge. What is it? Don't believe everything you think. I don't know if you've heard that. And try to improve it and try to think, how do we only become better practitioners if we go deep into these topics. But then when communicating, when presenting, I mean, you really have to distill it down to just sort of the base information. Otherwise, you'll, because it's just, everybody's not interested in the details that they can become challenging become challenging at times, but it tends to be the presentations, at least the ones I do, they don't vary that much. Maybe over time they'll vary more, but I'm personally more worried about getting over complicated when talking to others. So I sort of give a distilled version of the distilled version, because they're just, people aren't that interested, and you'll confuse them. And so that, but that's what's fun about this is it's like, this is like Eric and I, we haven't talked about this much detail the whole time because we always have too much work to do. We got a presentation or somebody to interview. So, but this is, and we didn't even talk about quantitative stuff at all, which is what I imagined. I was telling these guys ahead of time, it's like, this is the perfect time to get those questions in. But we'll have, maybe that'll be a theme for our next time together.
We could do a speed round where you just state the question. I'll do a one sentence response, and we'll get through a bunch of them, and we'll know where we want to go deeper next time.
Oh, I also like getting what do you have top of mind too? I thought that our speed dating here for qualitative stuff was great. We are getting close to the end here. Eric, what else would you like to share with us before we wrap things up?
Oh. And just a sense that the future is so bright for jobs to be done and the work that we're doing, because this isn't just about information or research. This is really about transformation. Mm. And the challenge is that the clients that I work with, what they really truly are struggling with is change.
Yeah.
And transformation and adopting the mindset. It has very little to do with opportunity landscapes and everything to do with, how do you powerfully serve people to think bigger than they're currently thinking? And to that, the opportunity is unlimitless. I'm personally super excited and passionate about framing my work in terms of what's the benefit to not just our clients, but to the world.
Yeah.
And so that's why I made my company a benefit corporation. It's also why I'm trying to go deeper into focus areas where I'm saying no to more work. So I can say yes to more work that's in healthcare and agriculture, just areas where I think a deeper dive, more writings, more publications to get these ideas out there could have this precipitous effect. And a deep gratitude for the three of you on this call, because I think there's two, I'm going to oversimplify the world and say there's two different types of Jossie Dunn practitioners. There's the type that are very dedicated almost to a religious level to their view of the world, to which all other views are irrelevant or wrong in some fundamental way.
Yeah.
And then there's views like what we're doing here. We're exploring a thought space because we're all committed to making this better together. And my view and your view and all our views are slightly different, but we're learning something in the process and we're converging to something better. That gets me excited. I gets me goosebumps. And like, the more that I can help three of you be successful and your listeners to be successful, the more I'll be successful, and the more we'll make an impact. So I really appreciate this time. This has been so fun.
For sure.
Oh, thank you.
Well, your company is Dark Horse Works. Tell us about the inspiration behind the name, and then we'll
wrap up. I had one of my coaches is Steve Chammer. He co-authored a book with Rich Litvin called The Prosperous Coach. It's an interesting read for anyone in professional services who wants to grow their practice. Their spirit animal, so to speak, is the hummingbird.
Oh.
And they chose the hummingbird because it's agile and it's responsive. And I thought, well, I didn't actually use this word, but I thought, what's a good spirit animal for innovation? And a dark horse comes from racing, the history of horse racing. And it's basically a little known entrant who's entered into the race and does surprisingly good. And I wanted to evoke this idea that we're all innovators that are aspiring. I wanted to more profoundly serve the innovators that are earlier in their growth cycles. So not the big multinationals, but people who are striving to be the best, but they're not quite there yet. They're not known, but they have really good ideas. Those are the people that I want to help the most. And so I chose the name. It was only later that I discovered there's a wine, there's many tattoo parlors that also share the Dark Horse name. So I'm clearly not a branding guy, but it works.
Well, if you ever decide to add tattoo services to your, then we'll have to figure out a new name. Then
it's a related job.
I'd like to get tattoos while discovering market opportunities. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, one final question for you, sir. We're going to put up billboards all up and down I-95. You know, you can put anything you want on those billboards for people to see as they drive by. What are you putting on that billboard?
Oh, wow. Ask for help. Something to this effect. I have, even though my views on what we do is departed from my ODI roots, I have a deep love for Tony Ulrich and all the folks at Stratagen. And one of the things that Tony would often encourage me to do in the career was, Eric, don't wallow in getting stuck. Just reach out for help. And you know what? I never asked him for help nearly enough. Mm. And I noticed that in my kids. I noticed that in my clients.
Yeah.
That we're not asking each other for help enough. And I think it's because partly it's fear. Partly it's like, no, I know I can figure this out. Yeah. But I think if we just all ask each other for help a little bit more often, we'd make more progress faster and be happier for doing it.
That's a pretty good answer.
I love it. I can't follow this up. Like,
fantastic. That's
awesome answer.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Eric, for spending time with us today. You're a great friend. I love working with you. And you might regret saying ask for help, because I already asked for it a lot of you already. But I'll certainly be doing that more in the future. All right. And that, friends, concludes today's Product Quest podcast. Follow us on LinkedIn and reach out to us anytime at productquestpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.
It was so fun. Thank you, guys.
It was really fun. Thank you very much. Yeah. I really loved the discussion.